Talk given Saturday, April 7th, 1979. As we all know, the entire universal process is characterized above all things by constant change. In our own lives, this change may be fortuitous, serving no special purpose, and sometimes quite useless. Or it may be a regressive change, and the regressiveness may be so bad that it becomes harmful, perhaps even destructive. And thirdly, there is progressive change. Progressive used specifically in the context of our development as human beings. And that kind of change means growth in the true sense, leading ultimately to full fruition as the human being, the full-fledged human. And the whole meaning of the word human then at last comes to flower with that kind of progressive change. But do remember that the word progress here must not be taken to mean a movement in direction. It all happens here and now. And if one does not grasp that sufficiently clearly, then we can make a good few mistakes in our efforts to bring about progressive change. What we try to bring about is something which we have thought out. And whatever we think out in that sense is something which is always wrong, because it is the thinking out by a conditioned mind, an imperfect mind. And it functions exclusively in terms of the functioning of the senses and the logical brain at work. So that it is always faulty. Now, what are the factors which influence progressive change for us? The most powerful factor is consciousness. Now, I'm using the word consciousness in the religious sense, the supremely religious sense. We tend to confuse consciousness, to mix it up with our thoughts and feelings, our intellectual processes, our sense perceptions when we are awake. Now, through the senses, it is perfectly true that we become conscious of that which the senses are conveying to us, provided we are attentive to the activity of the senses. If we are looking in a certain direction, but if our mind is completely preoccupied with something else, we don't see what actually is entering our eyes and making its impression upon the back of the brain. So we don't see the object. We are preoccupied with our own thinking process as such. Now, we are conscious of seeing this, that, or the other, hearing or touching or whatever it is, insofar as we pay attention to the activity of sense. But this is not consciousness as such in the wholly religious context, which means, as you all know, the context of transcendence, not of limitation, not of the finite and the mortal. It's in the context of the infinite, the eternal and the immortal. So consciousness in that sense is the most powerful determining factor, because consciousness in that sense is not specific to us. That is to say, it is not our property, so to say. We can't talk of my consciousness as we talk of my arm or my feelings or my psychical processes. Consciousness is transcendence itself. Now, as I say these things, they are just words. But to be conscious is something quite different from being attentive to sense impressions. When our activities in life are determined by our sense impressions, we are all the time being in relationship with what is finite, what is particular. We do not truly know the exact fact or truth of what the senses are conveying to us. But if we are truly conscious, then I have to use the word know. We know in a totally different manner. This is a knowing of such a nature that you could just as well, and perhaps more accurately, call it an unknowing. It is not conscious in the worldly sense of the word conscious. That is why philosophers and particularly logical analysts and such like get completely flummoxed by the language which the mystic or the man of religion uses. He says, but that is a state of complete vacuity. You are unconscious. You are not unconscious at all. When you are really conscious of something, of a great truth, of a great reality, then you are able spontaneously and naturally to live in accordance with that consciousness. If one is really conscious of love, then naturally and spontaneously one loves without having to think about it or remember it or control oneself in order to prevent oneself from performing some unloving act or being taken up by an unloving thought or feeling. You see, consciousness in that sense is a spiritual reality which defies all ordinary description. And you'll see, therefore, that it is quite different from the meaning of the word consciousness in our worldly sense. Now, it is this consciousness which exists as a potentiality, a divine potentiality within us. It's what theologians and mystics have called, people like them have called the spark of the divine within one, or as in Judaic teaching, what is called neshama, or what is called Shiva, embodied in the person. You see, different terms like that have been used, but it is precisely that which is a divine potentiality within us, which is not our property, which is not specific to us, in the same way that our psyche and our psychical activities are specific to us and separate from the psychical activities of others. That which is transcendent is always characterless. It has no There are no words, qualitative words, which we can attach to transcendence. And it is that which is in us as a divine potentiality. So now, we must never mix up, confuse consciousness with ordinary knowing or with what is ordinarily called conscious activity or the conscious mind, differentiating it from the unconscious mind and so forth. This is of very great importance. Now, it is our progressive changing in the course of our lives through living the religious life that this consciousness comes to complete fruition. That means that which is already transcendent does not come to fruition, but it takes complete charge of the entire psychophysical being, who becomes the unresisting medium through which the creative energy of the universe functions freely and displays completely and fully the meaning of being man. Manhood has at last been manifest through consciousness coming to fruition as man in this particular psychophysical organism, oneself. You see, this is an entirely different approach to, for understanding what consciousness is. If one really grasps this, then you will understand at once why the old teachers always talked of the ultimate, the supreme being, the transcendent, the primordial power or whatever it is, as pure consciousness. The Upanishads are the classic example of that. They have always equated, in fact, not merely equated, but said outright that Brahman, Atma, and pure consciousness are an identity. Are an identity. God, if you like to use the word, or if you like Eckhart's Gottheit, is this absolute consciousness, pure consciousness. So, its practical significance is what is important for us. If we become truly conscious of anything, that thing becomes naturally and spontaneously operative in all our thinking, feeling, speaking, and doing, without our having to keep it in mind, as we say, or think about it, or exercise any sort of inward control to suppress its opposite. You get it? Now, this is the meaning of being conscious in the religious sense, which means in the sense which expresses the functioning of true humanity in us. Now, that's the most powerful factor concerned with our progressive changing. The next is our needs. Bodily needs, psychological needs, and what may be called our psycho-spiritual needs. There is no such thing as a spiritual need in the supreme sense. There is no finite meaning to it at all. But psycho-spiritual, yes. And we'll see in a few moments, at least I hope to try and be able to present it adequately, why there is a thing like a psycho-spiritual need. Now, there is involved in all this a whole set of constructive influences. Health, good health, right upbringing and education, which involves right parents, good parents, who know how to bring up the children, who have a vision of the purpose of life, and who understand the ways and means by which the infant, from the time it is born and as it grows up, can be helped to move in the right manner through life. Its inner life, particularly, of thought, feeling, desire, and so forth. A most difficult task indeed. And education implies, similarly, good teachers, the right teachers. Health, upbringing and education, and good companions. It's one of the very interesting things that all the great religions, in the presentation of their practical, the practical living of the daily life, have insisted upon good companions. Because companions have a tremendous effect upon one. And it's here again, we are up against something very difficult. Then we must have good sense and intelligence. The release of intelligence out of our daily living process. Those are constructive influences bringing about progressive change. And of course, we all know what the destructive influences are. First and foremost, ignorance. But I don't know whether all of us appreciate that the worst aspect of ignorance is justice. We are ignorant of our ignorance. We don't know that we are an ignorant crowd all over the world. We think we know. Why? Take those people who aspire to living the religious life. But we study our Bible, we study our Veda, we study the Nikayas and texts of Mahayana. Or we are Zen people or Vedantists. And so we think we know. We know a whole heap of words, and pathetically distorted conceptions of the teachings as they actually exist in the scriptures. And if one lives long enough and lives with good sense, with an open mind, prepared to change and let go any old mental fixation as one sees its drawbacks and so forth, then we could be all right. We could grow that way. But we don't know that. And so we have the conceit to believe that we know. Think of the conflicts throughout the history of man. We know. Ours is the true faith. You don't know. And people have stooped, degraded themselves to the most bestial, repulsive acts in life. wars, cruelties, oppressions, which no animal is capable of. Only we can do this, that sort of thing. Because we are convinced, we know, you don't know. Look at all the totalitarian ideologies and philosophies. These wretched people who have suffered this, that and the other, either personally or observing their fellow human beings suffer, then they propound a philosophy and say, this is the thing that will save mankind. Quite extraordinary that mankind had to wait about 4 million years before these super geniuses who know better than nature or God or the evolutionary process came into existence. Such people are completely ignorant of their ignorance. See, this is a very important point. Then again, practically all human beings have hardly any real self-knowledge. That is to say, hardly any clear-sighted perception of the ways of the self as they function, particularly through our psychical processes, our thinking and feeling in our everyday life. We are ignorant of ourselves. Then again, of course, this which everybody knows, the destructive influences are wrong desires and impulses, whims, fancies, passions, and all the rest of it, which finally end up, which finally end up with making virtue, honesty, good work, dirty words. People are so ignorant that they don't see for a single second that it is they who are dirty, not virtue, goodness, beauty, harmony, and so forth. And doing an honest day's work in order to earn an honest living, without holding an entire nation to ransom. Then again, we have self-indulgence as a destructive force. Now this is very strange. The best-intentioned persons who think they are devoted to living the good life and so forth, they are very self-indulgent, and quite frequently they don't know that they are ignorant of the fact that actually they are living unmorally, whether it be in business terms or in terms of relationship with others of their own sex or the opposite sex or whatever it may be. We don't know it, and we rush into it. So, self-indulgence of all the senses, that is. Evil motives and vices, ill-breeding is a destructive influence that can't be helped by the child himself or herself. The parents are like that, and there we are. Wrong companions and the sheer misfortune of deprivation and disease, bodily and mental, that one can't help. One is born like that, and there you are. That's a destructive influence. This is where it becomes the business of society to do what it possibly can to help that unfortunate person. Then there is the stupidity and neglect of parents. Look how children are neglected in some form or other. And here perhaps the post-war generation, look how that has grown up. Because the mothers have found it very pleasant to go out and earn some money to spend it on their pleasures mainly, or gamble with it, or have a good time, as they call it. One has to be absolutely clear-seeing and deal with it in the manner in which the skilled surgeon uses his knife. No sentimentality or finding excuses for the wrongdoer. Wrongdoing is wrongdoing, and that's that. Let that be clearly understood. And there is the brutalization of the individual by circumstances or by oppression or by the excessive use, the indiscriminate use of gadgets and inventions and so forth. Man gets brutalized that way. Worst of all, perhaps, as far as we as individuals are concerned, is the lack of vision. Any sort of vision of the purpose of our existence and of the life trends which work through each of us as an individual organism. But the life trends are invincible. If the individual goes against the life trend, life just wipes him out. And that's that. Waste paper basket material. And not even good material for fertilizing the soil. It may sound as if I'm speaking very, very harshly. I'm not harsh at all. Very critical, if you like. Ruthlessly critical. Because unless we are completely clear-sighted and see facts as facts and acknowledge that this is the fact, there would be no chance whatsoever of healing the disease. That's the point. You have to acknowledge that, yes, I have got this disease. Once it's diagnosed, once one sees what it is, and then only can you take the next step of taking the medicine. Now, if and when we do have vision, then it is our responsibility, our personal responsibility, to cooperate with the vision of the life force and the way it works. It is our personal responsibility. That leads to progressive growth and to true fulfillment and all that that fulfillment implies. We must deal quite briefly with needs. Bodily needs, everybody knows. Food, shelter, warmth. Those are our essential and only real needs. All the rest are just a heap of wants and so on, which we acquire through desire, through being misled by advertisements, by seeing how people live in the world. We want to be with it, and generally we are with the devil and not with anything else. You're looking very solemn. So, bodily needs are just food, shelter, and warmth. Now, bodily needs are intimately tied up, mind you, with psychological needs. And psychological needs are of primary importance for us as individual people. Happiness, security, love, peace of mind, a congenial job, some degree of success, and social acceptance. our psychological needs. Now, note one very important difference between physical bodily needs and psychological needs. With regard to bodily needs, we are on the whole capable of saying, with respect to food, oh, this is good food, it agrees with me, it's good, and I am healthy on this rather than on that. And we can also say, I've had enough of it, I am not going to gorge myself. Occasionally people do. Then, of course, they have to pay the penalty for it, because nature doesn't suspend her laws because of any individual's desire. The quality of mercy doesn't operate where just the pure chemistry and physics of the body is concerned. With regard to our bodily needs, we can do that. We can have enough warmth. If it gets too hot, we turn the fire off, or whatever it is, you see. And so we live fairly balanced where bodily needs are concerned. But consider one outstanding feature in relation to psychological needs. Love, happiness, and so on. We long for happiness, for love, for being accepted socially, and so forth. It is a longing. There is no concreteness about these things. Food, concrete, so much. Warmth, such a temperature, so much. But where the psychological part comes in, our psychical nature, we long for it, and long intensely for it. So whilst we will say enough food, enough warmth, with respect to the psyche, we say we long for complete security, perfect success, eternal love, everlasting happiness. Now notice the difference in context. With respect to the bodily needs, we accept finitude, particularity, and so forth. With respect to our psychological needs, finitude and particularity are out of the situation. The perfect, the complete, the eternal, the everlasting, and so on. But this belongs to the transcendent context. So now, a very important element functioning in our lives comes into play. And if we can become truly conscious of this in the deepest sense, then there is the completion of what we call the living of the holy life. In the Buddha's words, the brahmacharya has been trod. One has lived the holy life. Now, how is it with us in actual fact with respect to our psychological needs? Practically, the majority of human beings have a certain degree of happiness, security, success, and so forth. And they also have its opposite. In different measure, of course. You see, it is more intense or less intense, as the case may be. So we have both. And our reaction is to try and get rid of unhappiness, to get rid of insecurity, and so forth. We never think in terms of learning the right lessons out of our actual circumstance outside us, and the actuality, the actual state of our inner psychical nature and procedure. We don't think that way. The result is that we live in perpetual conflict inside ourselves. And what is the conflict? Here it is not a case of a conflict between one finite and particular and another finite and particular. It is a conflict between that which is finite and particular against that which is transcendent, against that which is eternal and infinite and immortal. So, of course, we hopelessly lose out every time. The vast bulk of people, therefore, before their lives end, never have any vision, never any understanding. So many people live soured lives, and they put up a brave front, as they call it. They say, "Oh well, we've got to keep a stiff upper lip. We've got mustn't wear our heart on our sleeves," and so forth and so forth. But it's a life of continuous repression. And it is a life of inward depression in the deepest sense. It's a life where so much unnecessary sorrow and suffering invades us and is actually victorious over us, whilst we pretend to show an image of being all right and so forth. Look very carefully into it. We must examine ourselves very, very carefully. Now, when we see that our psychological needs are of a nature which require adjectives associated, which belong to the transcendent context, perfect, eternal, everlasting, and so forth, then we are aware, even if dimly, of a strong desire to go beyond the bounds of the limited and finite towards the infinite and eternal, to move out of the imperfect and incomplete into the perfect and the complete. So, although we experience life and are conscious of our world in terms of duality and conflict, like a seesaw of opposites, our basic urge is towards being conscious in terms of wholeness and harmony. That we must understand. Our basic urge, and it's a very interesting fact that this urge functions both ways, through the living organism itself, with the immense power of nature and natural evolution behind it to bring it to complete fulfillment, and this power of the divine, of God, of the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, drawing us, inviting us, and waiting with infinite patience till we respond to that urge to come to our fruition. It's a purely physical as well as a purely spiritual urge. And if we have the intelligence and the power to perceive what that implies, we shall see that our pathetic discrimination, separation between what we call the material, the mortal, the world of the flesh and the devil and so forth, and the world of the spirit, the world of the divine, is a mistaken differentiation altogether. It's a mistaken opposition. It is convenient just for a certain period in our lives, in order that we may go through that process of transformation of our power to perceive the fact It is helpful that way only, and then we see that the separation is an entirely false separation. The universe is a universe, one great unitary whole. And we are, and have been up to now, the agents of introducing division, separation, conflict into that unitary whole. This is why when the Catholics say man is born in sin, they are pronouncing a truth of such dimensions that they themselves just don't know what it means. This is the meaning of sin. Whatsoever harms or tries to harm or hurt or disrupt the unity of the universe, the unity of the totality of the whole, that is sin, a breaking up. Now, we know the manner in which we are conscious of ourselves and of the world. We have gone into this so often through the years. We are isolatively self-conscious in relationship with all human beings, and we are separatively conscious in relationship with all objects. We see all objects as different objects. We see all human beings as separate human beings. Separativeness and isolativeness marks our whole psychological life and our limited awareness. That is how we are actually conscious. That is, and I'm using the word conscious now in the worldly meaning of the term conscious. You see, we are conscious of other people, of other objects than ourselves. And our self-consciousness has number one place, and the rest of the totality is of secondary importance, and it is called the not-self. A miraculous disproportion. And there are 4,000 million other not particularly intelligent people who are just like that. What do you expect for the human race? What can happen? What miserable conflict. But to some, in fact to many, there come those wonderful magic moments when one is awakened out of this state of consciousness, this mode of awareness, this sinful mode of awareness, and one suddenly experiences as a living reality a complete relationship, a complete harmony with anything and everything, with any person and every person throughout the entire cosmos. And one knows somehow that this is true. This is a matter of fact experience. It is the simple, obvious fact. And it may last for an hour, a day, a year. It can do that. And one feels as if one is perpetually in heaven, in complete harmony with everybody. But as and when one returns to ordinary consciousness, with the emphasis on the functioning of the senses and the brain, and our limited isolativeness, then nostalgia comes in. Ah, if only that state can be brought back. How can one maintain it permanently? How can one live in that state forever? You can't bring the experience back. This is the mistake that so many make. That is why there are only a very few of those who have such an experience who are able to really to tread the path and blossom out, fully blossom out. Otherwise, all the rest just remain buds which have become blighted, and then they die. So this is where religion steps in. Religion in the full and true sense of the word. And when one's intelligence really awakens, one sees that it is impossible for the individual to produce a system, a way of life, by which he as a person achieves that state. You can't. Because our existence is completely determined by the fact that the rest of the universe also exists. And what actually happens, therefore, is that if we see this, become truly conscious of it, we let go of any and every effort to bring about a result for ourselves. We let the universal life urge, we let this creative power which acts in eternity function through us. It is we ourselves in our psychophysical life who present all the obstacles to that functioning. And the right understanding and right way to live the religious life, therefore, consists in cleansing ourselves. We cleanse ourselves by seeing the fact as it is within ourselves. All our conflicts, all our misdirected efforts to achieve this, that or the other, realize nirvana, the kingdom of heaven, do good as we in our pathetically partial way see good. All those are obstructions. They are mistaken efforts. See the fact as it is inside oneself. Just see it, see it, see it. Become fully conscious of the fact. And then you will find that the obstructiveness has completely changed. There is no more obstruction. Because our mode of awareness of existence has undergone the complete transformation. It has grown out of the mortal and the finite into the immortal and the eternal. And this is something which the brain can never know. You are conscious now in the true sense of the word conscious. In the true sense of the word, which means you are conscious in the manner in which consciousness by the greatest of the religious teachers was ascribed as was spoken of as being identical with the ultimate truth, the ultimate reality. And it is that which is the power that functions through you. And the moment we become personally conscious that, this power is working through a me, then there is an obstruction to that power. Otherwise, that power just utilizes you, and you are the full flower of humanity.